because having all this data flowing through our digital tubes is simply not enough. We have to figure out ways of taking the data and analyzing it and predicting and suggesting and doing all sorts of things that we really couldn't do until this new technology came on the scene.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work.
Hey, Shiva, how are you doing?
Hey, Nicole, I'm doing really well. Thank you. Stormy weather. We just got past the big storm, and I'm really glad to see a little bit of sunshine and hope everybody's doing okay after this big storm. How are you doing, Nicole?
I'm doing well. It's true. I think California, when it rains, and it was raining hard with lots of flooding, lots of power outages, I think we're just not used to this extreme of weather. And so I think definitely threw us through some sort of a loop. So happy to be home and safe and have power. It's definitely a luxury. But very excited to be talking today about a really important topic of artificial intelligence in medicine. Artificial intelligence and technology are revolutionizing all industries, including healthcare. With the most recent release of ChatGPT, we are excited to discuss how AI is currently being used and how it will be incorporated into healthcare. How are you feeling about AI in medicine?
Well, I mean, I think you answered it well when we were chatting before. It is complicated. I think the way I feel about it is I feel optimistic and excited. I've begun using ChatGPT a bit, and I'm kind of excited about what it can do and how it can help. I also feel a little bit nervous thinking about the future and, you know, what are some of the downsides in terms of medicine and health education and, you know, those things, Nicole. We'll have plenty of time to talk about it, but I'm excited mostly, and also excited to learn more, and also wondering if we as a human race can be somewhat cautious as well. What about you, Nicole? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I do. I think AI is complicated. It's exciting, new technology. And I think anytime new technology is brought into the healthcare system, it does take us a while to adapt it and to kind of figure out what the pros and cons of it is. I can imagine, just because we do have a lot of chart burden, to have some sort of technology to be able to help construct our notes based on what we're seeing in our interactions with the patient, I think that's a powerful tool. And having AI be able to scribe, I think that's really a wonderful resource. I think one of the caveats is ChatGPT is trained from all the literature and all of everything that's been published by humans. And humans have biases. So therefore, ChatGPT also is inherently biased. And I think we have to be careful to toe that line of our training and the knowledge that we have and the ability for us to problem solve and not relying 100% on technology. I think there has to be that towing of the line and kind of figuring out what works best. And it'll be really exciting to hear from one of the specialists in the field, Dr. Bob Wachter, today to be able to talk about this really important topic. We are unbelievably privileged to introduce our incredible speaker today, Dr. Bob Wachter. Dr. Wachter is a professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSF. Bob Wachter has authored 300 articles and 6 books, including the book, The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age, which was a New York Times bestseller. In 1996, Dr. Wachter coined the term hospitalist and is often considered the father of the hospitalist field, the fastest growing medical specialty in U.S. history. Modern Healthcare magazine has ranked Dr. Wachter 13 times as one of the 50 most influential physician executives in the U.S. During the COVID pandemic, Dr. Wachter's tweets on COVID-19 were viewed over 500 million times and served as a trusted source of information on the clinical, public health, and policy issues surrounding the pandemic. We are incredibly privileged and excited to welcome Dr. Bob Wachter to discuss the integration of artificial intelligence in healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Wachter.
Thank you, Nicole. I see my mother's fax came through. I appreciate you going through my bio that way. Look forward to chatting with you.
Dr. Wachter, we're so delighted to have you and appreciate your time. We wanted to just tell you how we start off each of our episodes because we are called Meaningful Medicine. And we like to start by asking our guests if you could, in short, share a meaningful moment from early in your training or early in your life that was particularly formative or a defining type of experience.
Probably the most defining experience, I was already in medical school. And I got a call that my father, who was, I think, 51 at the time, had passed out on a train going into work. And he was ultimately diagnosed with gastric cancer and was told that he had a year or two to live. And I was devastated. I just thought, you know, that he was a really important person in my life. Neither of my parents went to college. I clearly kind of lived for their children and was an incredibly wise person, although not... didn't have a very robust education in his life. Anyway, he got his affairs in order, really focused on living life to the fullest for the next few years. And he passed away at 91, about 40 years later, having outlived all of his physicians. So it taught me a whole lot of things. One is sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine. But having been on the receiving end, actually, I was a chipper medical student, came back to see his endoscopy, and the gastroenterologist put a teaching scope on, and I was looking down, and the gastroenterologist, he went down into my father's stomach, gulped quite loudly, and I said, and explained to me, this is not what I expected to find. I expected to find an ulcer or gastritis. So it's probably the most memorable moment I've had in medicine and taught me a lot of things, but mostly I feel like we got incredibly lucky to have another 40 years of him. And it gave me a sense of what it feels like to be on the receiving end of bad news.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I love hearing about how we don't know everything. And I think the patient's resilience and the support of their family can also get them where they need to go. And happy to hear about your dad. Going into the topic today, can you tell us a little bit about what is generative artificial intelligence or AI?
Well, in a way, you're asking the wrong person because I was not a computer science major in college. I was a political science major in college. So when I give a talk on AI, I show a cartoon that I love, which shows a professor in front of a whiteboard. And there's a bunch of math equations and regressions and differential equations on the left side. And then it says, and then a miracle occurred. And then there's a bunch more equations on the right side. I'm sort of in the then a miracle occurred mode. I mean, what it is from the layman's perspective, and I sort of think this is all that most people need to know about it, is a new form of artificial intelligence that really acts like the human brain, is capable of coming up with predictions and conclusions based on it learning from data and information without the old way we used to think about artificial intelligence, that you had to program in intelligence, program in algorithms and guidelines and things like that. It can do that just by ingesting the corpus of the internet and information that it has access to, and then can come out with outputs that I think are pretty remarkable. The one that most people know is a subset of it, which is large language models, where it basically does that with the entire corpus of the information you can get its hands on from in the English language, but actually in every language, and can predict what the next word was going to be so they can write an essay for you and write it in the form of Hemingway or write it in the form of me, as it turns out. But there are all sorts of other forms that involve not language, but visual representations. I think people are seeing more and more of it. But I think it's a considerable uptick in the capabilities and the potential of artificial intelligence from where we were before. And I think it does present the possibility of a different future for medicine now that we've seen what it's capable of.
I love that phrase, ingesting the corpus of the internet. That's quite a big bite. And it's just really fabulous to think about how much has changed since the time you wrote your book, which I think was in 2015, till now. And Nicole and I both enjoyed very much your Grand Rounds talk a couple of months ago on AI, also at UCSF. And one of the things that comes up is the first iteration maybe of AI in healthcare was, as you talked about it, was the electronic health record. And I think you had a slide that said, you know, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, it seemed like a great idea. And I think the expectation with artificial intelligence is in everyone's mind, this will make us better, faster, smarter, you know, everything will improve. And we'd love if you could talk a little bit about the productivity paradox and how does that relate to AI and AI in healthcare specifically?
Yeah, I think it's worth thinking about the electronic health record as being the foundation, but not the solution. And I don't think any of us understood this. I've said many stupid things to mentees over the years, but probably the stupidest was when I hired a guy named Russ Cucina, who is our chief health information officer. He just finished an informatics fellowship, and he came to UCSF maybe 15 years ago. And I said, you're going to have this really exciting job. You're going to be helping us implement this big computer system called an electronic health record and get us to go from scribbling on pieces of paper and using post-it notes and storing charts on Lazy Susans to this new electronic universe where we store it digitally and move it around digitally. And I said, that's going to be really exciting for maybe 3, 4, 5 years. And then what will you do when that's done? Because that's what I thought digitization was of healthcare. We just, if we build the electronic health record and implement it, we were kind of done. And I've come to realize how incredibly stupid that was, that the electronic health record really is a scaffolding for then what we need to, I mean, storing your data digitally is useful because you've gotten rid of the doctor's handwriting problem and is useful because I can read a chart sitting at home or two different people can look at a chart at the same time or I can send an electronic prescription to Walgreens. Those are all good things. But I think we fundamentally misunderstood the problem. We thought just collecting the data and moving it around in simple ways like that was really going to be massively useful. And it turns out it's necessary but not sufficient. And what is then required is you take all that data that you're storing and understand it, understand your patients, increase the ability of patients to do things for themselves, understand your ability to communicate with specialists or nurses or other people or to learn from the literature in all sorts of different ways. And you don't get that out of the box with electronic health records. The productivity paradox was a concept I wrote the book, The Digital Doctor, in 2015, in large part out of disappointment because I had been so excited about the electronic health record, thought it was going to be relatively straightforward and solve all of our problems. And lo and behold, it solved some, but it created others. And the moment I decided to write a book about it, was when we gave a kid a 40-fold overdose of an antibiotic in a completely digital system. And it was in analyzing, I was chair of our patient safety committee at the time at UCSF. And as we sort of reviewed this slow motion train wreck, we realized that although the electronic health record was preventing certain errors, it was actually creating others, in part because people had turned their brains off when the computer said something, you just believed it, even if it said to give a ridiculous dose to a 16-year-old kid. So I was noodling over, like, why is this so hard? When I talked to doctors, most of them were unenthusiastic about their computers. And in fact, many of them complained about it bitterly. And I kind of said, is this a one-off on medicine? Is it something about doctors or maybe our computers are so bad? And I came upon this concept popularized by a professor now at Stanford named Eric Bernyovsen called the productivity paradox of IT. And it was quite reassuring to see this because it said healthcare, we're not uniquely bad. We're just sort of normal. What happens in industry after industry is the technology looks great on the PowerPoint slides and the demos and gets massively hyped, in part because it has to be or you wouldn't go through the trouble of buying it and implementing it. People put it in and the expectation is that it's going to yield massive benefits in quality or productivity or anything you care about, it's going to just make the thing you do better right out of the box. And the paradox is that doesn't happen. And people are left scratching their heads, like, why are we not seeing the promised benefits 1 year, 2 years, 5 years later, 10 years later in some industries? And every industry sees this. And the good news is that every industry ultimately fixes it and the paradox goes away. In Eric and others' research, what they show is that the reason it doesn't happen out of the box is that industries typically aren't smart or creative enough to do anything other than airlift in this technology, turn it on, but not spend any time or energy thinking about how is the work going to change? How do we need to change the people and the way they're trained and how we govern this and the culture? And so they just sort of plop it into the existing workflow, and lo and behold, it doesn't work that well. And why does it take 5 or 10 years? Because it takes 5 or 10 years mostly for young people to come in and say, why are we doing this thing this way? Like, why is the doctor's note in the electronic health record. What does it look like a piece of paper under a tab? Well, because it always looked like a piece of paper under a tab. What else could it be? Well, if you've grown up in the more modern age, you sort of think about a Twitter feed or a Google Doc and collaborative charting. You think about all of the richness of all the sites you use that beautifully integrate words with video, with audio. You know, that's sort of a natural way you think about it. Whereas for folks of my generation, like, what else could it look like? It looks like a piece of paper under a tab. So a lot of the way the productivity paradox gets resolved is, first of all, the technology gets better. Version 1.0 is always not very good. But that turned out not to be the key. The key really is that people rethink the work, rethink the nature of the work, think about, all right, we have this digital thing and we should think about doing the work a brand new way. So that was a concept I found quite liberating. And if you read the book, the first 26 chapters, I believe, are pretty grumpy. They were like my manifestation of why is this so problematic? Why are people so unhappy with it? And really what I did was spend a year talking to everybody I could think of, from CEOs of IT, of EHR companies, to I spent a day at Boeing headquarters, like flying a 777 and talking to their engineers, to doctors and nurses and patients. And so the first 26 chapters are like, here's what I've come to understand about why this is so hard and why we were naive to believe that you just flip a switch and it's all good. And then chapter 27, I had some people come up to me and say, like, who ghost wrote that chapter for you? Because it's the sunny, optimistic, the future is going to be great. This is going to yield real benefits. It's going to make the jobs of doctors and nurses better and easier. It's going to make the job of being a patient or a family member better, more democratized. It's going to cut healthcare costs. And people said, like, who wrote that for you? But I said, no, I can see where this goes. It's just not there yet. And I think where this goes was partly waiting for this new AI to layer into our existing systems, because having all this data flowing through our digital tubes is simply not enough. We have to figure out ways of taking the data and analyzing it and predicting and suggesting and doing all sorts of things that we really couldn't do until this new technology came on the scene.
That's such a good way to put it. I think thinking about, you know, with a new tool, you also have to think about who's going to be using the tool. What does that workflow look like? And who's going to be buying into this new tool? And are they going to be trained? And so really thinking about that full picture and how it's going to integrate is extremely important. I'd love to talk about really how artificial intelligence or AI is currently being integrated into healthcare.
Yeah, it's still pretty early. I'd say probably its greatest integration into healthcare is by individual people experimenting. I mean, I don't know about you, but periodically, if I've got a complicated patient who I normally would go to UpToDate to look something up, or maybe call my friend the consultant for a curbside consult, I'm now just as likely to put it into GPT-4 and see what it says. And I have to say, most of the time, it says something pretty intelligent. I mean, not all that different than what I might expect, you know, from running into a pal in the cafeteria and running a quick case by him or her. So I'd say that the use cases now are pretty informal and kind of a thousand flowers blooming. Everybody trying to figure out how this thing can help them do their work better. So, you know, a lot of drafting letters of recommendation and drafting. I'm writing a report now for a national group on the impact of patient safety, of AI and patient safety, and took basically the transcript of the conversations during a conference and plopped it into GPT-4 and said, summarize this for me. So I think it's at this point not very institutionally based, because institutions are still kind of figuring this out. What's going to quickly happen, and it's already happening a little bit at UCSF and at some other institutions, is we'll begin using it for mostly back office and operational functions. How can we predict the flow of patients into the ED so we can figure out the staffing we need for the emergency department, which up till now has been, well, you know, Thursdays seem to be busy, but now you can take all the data and put it in and it can give you a credible answer. How can we write a prior authorization to an insurance company for, you know, for a given medicine? One company developed an AI tool where they told me, if you just type in the letter O, it will draft Ozempic prior authorization United Healthcare. Just all you have to do is type in O and that knows that's what you're trying to do. Of course, United Healthcare has its own AI designed to reject your AI generated prior authorization. So there's going to be a little bit of an arms race. But I think we're starting with kind of back office functions because of the recognition that in healthcare, we made a huge mistake in the AI world about 30 years ago, where they had some very early, very rudimentary AI tools. And they decided to start on what they thought was the most interesting problem, but turns out to be by far the hardest problem, which is diagnosis. And I asked some of the leading AI experts at the time, like, why did you do that? In retrospect, that was such a terrible mistake. And they said it was the most interesting problem. It just seemed logical. But I think we're smarter now. And even though these tools are far, far more powerful than the ones they had, I think people are quite reluctant to start out with high stakes areas like the AI makes the diagnosis, the AI suggests the therapy. I think where we're first going to see it impact physician-patient relationships are going to be in digital scribes. So, you know, one of the things that electronic health records did was markedly increase the burden for documentation. And people have talked about how, you know, the EHRs were so bad, they created that. They didn't really create that. What they did was create an environment where all of a sudden UCSF or Aetna or Medicare could say, doctor, it would be good if you documented these five things, because if you do, the bill would be a better bill, or will look better in terms of quality measures, or just ethically, we want you to document that you ask the patient whether they wear seat belts or have a gun at home. In the old days, which Nicole, you will not remember, but Shiva, you do, there was no way anybody could make me do anything because I was scribbling on a piece of paper. And so the only review of what I did would be weeks later if someone tried to decipher my handwriting. But once there were computers, you could make the user do anything. And all of a sudden, the documentation requirements became massive. Up until about a year or two ago, the technology, the AI, was not good enough to truly replace either the doctor doing the documentation or a human scribe hearing a conversation and turning it into an appropriately formatted note. Just in the past year, the technology is now ready for prime time. So at UCSF, we are rolling out digital scribes. And I guess within a year or two, pretty much every encounter, certainly ambulatory encounter, there will be some device, if the patient permits, recording the conversation and turning it into a note. I think that's the first thing. I think in addition to that, there are now tools in Epic that allow you to summarize the chart, the patient's chart. And rather than waiting through 200 pages to get a one-page summary of the chart, to draft a discharge summary or a patient note after an encounter. I think another thing that exploded on us that we hadn't anticipated was once we created these patient portals, which again sounds like a great idea. We want to democratize care. Isn't it great if patients have access to their information? We gave them all this information, made it impossible to get an appointment with their doctor, and very helpfully put a little button on the screen that said, send a message to your healthcare team. And it's free. And lo and behold, they did it, which is makes them rational. And lo and behold, the docs are on their knees trying to figure out how I deal with, after 9 hours of seeing patients all day, 2 hours of inboxes to message to deal with. So another not totally high risk, but not zero risk use case is, can you look at all of those messages, triage them, deal with the ones you can deal with, refills, making an appointment. But the ones that actually are asking for medical advice, can you draft for the doctor or maybe the NP a draft response to that request and then save the clinician a lot of time? So a lot of use cases, none of them in the short term are, let's get rid of the doctor and make the diagnosis and suggest a treatment. Although I do believe fairly soon, it's not a very long step to the AI drafting my note for me, to the AI suggesting, you know, this, what I just heard, and what I've read about the patient's past history, this is consistent with lupus and or four other things. Doctor, you know, what do you think? And that, to me, is not a bad thing as long as the doctor remains the driver of the car and the AI remains the co-pilot.
Right, which brings up the issue of something you spoke about before, and Nicole and I were talking about automation complacency, that the idea that the doctor might, or whoever is using AI, might then trust the computer, the intelligence that might be greater than it is. As you said, like about the wrong dose for the pediatric patient, we tend to trust that, well, I didn't look that up, so maybe it's right, or it's telling me it's this, so I'll go down that path. So that leads me to ask you a little bit about some of the pitfalls that might be associated with integrating and using AI in medicine Could you talk a little bit about that? Because there is a lot of optimism. And just the other thing I was thinking of is I mentor a lot of students who are, as you know, many are post-bac students who are, you know, planning to go to medical school. What better way to learn about medicine and the workings of a physician than to be a scribe, which was itself a new industry since the electronic health record came out and people became overwhelmed as clinicians. And now it sounds like that landscape of human scribes might be lost because we'll have digital scribes. So there's so much changing in the landscape and in the life of medicine.
There's a lot there. I the goal of medicine and healthcare, it's sad to say this in a way because I love my job and I have a daughter who's a second year medical resident and son-in-law is an intern, so I want them to have great jobs and be happy. But the goal is to produce the best health at the lowest cost. And the system will move in that direction and won't care that much about our jobs. We will, and we should. But tasks that can be done well by technology at a lower cost and with less friction for a patient, I think the trick here will be that will certainly take away some jobs. And I think you're right. I think the job of scribe lasted about 7 or 8 years and probably is going to go away. But, that $30 an hour we were paying for the scribe got paid for by somebody. And if that can be done at $10 an hour for what we should pay the company, then that's probably progress. Although, understand it's disruptive. Versions of that will probably happen throughout the healthcare system. Now, what I think is reassuring for those of us that like our jobs, and I've got, when I send a message to the department that I run, it goes to 3,000 people. So those are the people that have jobs in my world that I'm at least partly responsible for, is there's so much more that needs to be done. And in healthcare, at least, it's not only that it's too expensive to hire all these people, but in many cases, we can't find them. And I think that will be helpful politically. In that, if you think about the two biggest strikes in the United States last year, one was the auto industry, the other was Hollywood. They were partly about wages and benefits, but they were partly about being replaced by AI. I think it would be naive to think that those concerns wouldn't emerge in healthcare if it turns out that AI is beginning to replace radiologists or pathologists or dermatologists. Guessing we'll hear from those doctors and their lobbies. But on the other hand, try to find enough radiologists or dermatologists or primary care docs or emergency medicine doctors or clerks or scrub nurses, go through the entire system. In most of healthcare, we don't have enough people to do all of the tasks. And the people that we have are overwhelmed and burned out, and partly because they spend so much of their time doing things that you really don't need someone with their education and their skills and, frankly, their cost to do. And so, what is this like 50 years from now? I don't know. I won't be around, but I'm a little scared about how many jobs will be lost. But I think over the foreseeable future, this is net good. I think for the professions of healthcare, there will be some jobs that go away. There'll be some new jobs that are created. But I think the needs are so great and only increasing that I think this will certainly, I think, be good for patients. Now, the issue of the downsides, they're massive. And I think if we don't think very carefully about them, we'll get some things very wrong. On the other hand, I think it's important not to overemphasize them. So for example, the early hallucinations that we saw from the early, and I'm talking a year ago when I say early, this has moved so fast, from GPT 3.5, were pretty troubling. If you go and put in the same query into GPT 4 today, there's a better than even chance you won't see the same making stuff up. You may still see some. So we need someone to double check and be sure it's right. But they've gotten better pretty fast. I worry not that much about hallucinations. I worry about bias. And this, we talk a lot about bias in the AI systems. But I guess it's important to recognize that the bias in the AI systems completely reflects the bias in healthcare. It can't do anything other than look at what we did last week and parrot that. So as Joe Biden likes to say, don't compare me against the almighty, compare me against the alternative. And the alternative is a healthcare system that does not work very well, is bankrupting society, has quality, safety, access, and equity problems. It's not a very high bar to be better than that. And I think in a lot of areas, I think it's easy to take on the AI, and some of the concerns and objections are completely legitimate. I think we've got to think very carefully about them. But it's not like we're inserting it into a perfect system. The system is massively flawed and has a lot of room for improvement. I'm left with my biggest worry being the one of automation complacency, automation bias, and de-skilling. They're three connected but not completely the same terms. And here's the best way I have to frame it. You know, if the AI were right 50% of the time and wrong 50% of the time, we just keep doing what we're doing. We wouldn't use it because it's like when a spell checker is, you know, right 50% of the time, it's worthless because you have to check everything anyway. You wasted your time. When the AI is right 100% of the time, that's spectacular. Then you get into the problem, I'm not sure what we're all going to do for a living. For the foreseeable future, in most of the domains, whether it's reading an x-ray, reading a path slide, suggesting diagnoses, predicting whether a patient's going to be readmitted or return to the ER or go to the ICU, drafting my note, the AI will be right 80% of the time, 90% of the time, 95%, maybe 99%. But not 100. And the system, the safety system we will create will inevitably be, all right, we need a human to check over the, look over the shoulder of the AI and bless it and sign off on it. We do that, first of all, because the AI is not perfect. Second of all, because we need somebody to sue. And so we need a doctor and or a health system to be liable for the thing. And those are the two main reasons, I think. So I've done a lot of my work in patient safety, and they talk about sort of robust safety fixes and non-robust safety fixes. That's an incredibly unrobust safety fix. And it can give you the illusion of safety because you say, well, AI is reading the x-ray, but the radiologist will check and be sure it's okay. The AI drafted my note, but I'll read it over and I'll sign it. How carefully do you read over? Maybe your life is not mine. Mine is I get probably 200 documents a day to sign. I have to confess, I do not read every single one. That would be all I did for a living. So there are a whole bunch of things that get me to trust that it's right, and I'll glance at it, but it's not a very robust safety check. When the AI is right 99.9% of the time, how good is the human going to be in saying, I don't really trust this thing. I better read it over carefully. I still have the skills to be good at this thing, whatever it is, and I'm not going to overtrust the computer. Humans don't operate that way. We will learn to trust the computer. Our sign-offs will be perfunctory. And it just raises a whole bunch of interesting questions for educators and technology designers without obvious answers. You know, the example I give in my talks is that of the auto drive on Tesla or a car that has autopilot. And I love this. There's a line in the Tesla's driver's manual that was written by a bunch of very high-priced attorneys that clearly have a good sense of humor, because it says basically in like the most catch-22 doublespeak, the auto drive feature requires active driver supervision. Like, if that's true, why did you call it auto drive? but of course, that's mostly about liability. But what it means is you stick this thing on auto drive, it's going to drive the car by itself, but once every 100,000 miles, it's going to take a left turn into a concrete pillar, and you, driver, will have a tenth of a second to react. That's a joke of a safety system. Obviously, that's not doable. That's not going to work. And so you have to be thoughtful and strategic about this issue. If you're going to have humans do backup, what does that look like? To be sure they stay awake, to be sure that they have the skills to do the backup, they have the incentives to do the backup. And just saying, oh, we have a system where the human's going to do a second read is a very unsatisfying safety system.
You mentioned the hallucinations. It's pretty scary when you think about it that the AI, you ask the AI questions, and then it comes up with maybe inaccurate and kind of made up facts and says it in a way that you kind of start to question yourself. Is this actually true? Am I missing something? And so I know that they're continuing to do iterations and try to avoid these quote unquote hallucinations. But for me, that's a very scary aspect of trusting and using AI.
Yeah, no, I think that it's a dominant issue is this issue of trustworthiness. Is it worthy of trust? And then how much trust you give it are related, but not the same. You know, there's a lot of work on hallucinations to try to make them better. Humans sometimes hallucinate too. And so again, it's not the almighty. I think it's going to get better, but in some ways, as it gets better, then the automation complacency problem kicks in. Right now, when I ask AI for an answer, on something where the stakes are high, I'm going to read it over pretty carefully to be sure, you know, I'm not going to take its word for it. And, you know, when it says, well, here's a reference that supports the thing, I'm going to click on it and be sure it's real, because every now and then it'll have made it up. It's a, you know, it tries to be a crowd pleaser. But in the future, if I check it, you know, 100 times and it's right every time, I'm probably going to stop checking. So you end up in the situation where I think for now we're probably okay because it's novel enough and we don't trust it that much that we check it. Now, there's an issue there, which is people like me, you know, grew up in an era without any of these tools. And so it probably is somewhere deep down in my neurons are somewhat skeptical about all this newfangled technology. I feel like, you know, the old guy chasing the kids off his lawn. Whereas for younger people that grew up with the technology, it may not be natural to double check it. And then over time, you know, Nicole, your generation will be the older people and you will not have grown up in an era where you sort of knew anything other than this. The example there that comes to mind is when I was writing my book, I had the privilege of interviewing Captain Sullenberger, the pilot who landed the plane in the Hudson. And Sully's an amazing guy and was describing, we were talking about a couple of aviation accidents that had happened where basically the AI glitched or the technology glitched and the plane essentially went off autopilot in a middle of a difficult circumstance and the pilots had to do the right thing and they did the wrong thing. And what Sully said is, and I'll never forget this, he said they were flying a plane they were not familiar with, which is a plane where the technology is not helping you. And I think, you know, it is going to be a little bit of a generational problem that for younger people coming of age at this era, what would happen if the EHR went down and we had to exhume the paper from our warehouse and, you know, use that, go down to the lab as I used to do and go through a shoebox looking for my patient's lab results. I mean, everybody would be flabbergasted. So no one of this era has ever seen anything other than digital medicine. And I think the coming era, no one will have seen a world where you didn't get a lot of decision support from the AI. And that's good if the AI is really accurate. And even if it blows it every now and then, it may be net good in the same way that when the driverless car has a fatal accident, it makes a headline in the newspaper, but the 30,000 deaths a year from distracted drivers don't make headlines. You know, it may be that the driverless car is still safer, even if every now and then it screws up. So these are sort of interesting issues that come up in every industry that digitizes, and I think we'll go through all of them in healthcare, and obviously the stakes are very high, and if we blow it, you know, people can die.
Yeah, scary realities, and I know for me at least, I couldn't imagine right now, you know, doing high school or college with generative AI because, you know, you ask a question and then you get all the research kind of handed to you where, you know, I was maybe the end of the generation where we went to libraries, you know, you still had to go to journals, you had to look at the literature and you really had to problem solve and really look at the information available and come up with your own conclusions. So I just hope that that aspect of training doesn't go away or is diminished. And we want to have these kind of critical thinkers that are coming up and not relying as much on technology, but also making their own medical decisions and their own.
I hope so. You know, the good news is we worried about the same thing for your generation, which is my kids' generation, when Google came out. We said they're all going to turn their brains off and just, you know, do a search and look it up in Wikipedia. And, you know, you guys turned out okay. I mean, and so probably this will work out okay. Although, you know, it is different than anything we've seen before. And it's so conversational and so human-like that I do think we have to keep it as an open question whether there will be so much skill loss and what the consequences of that will be.
Dr. Wachter, I want to ask you about how you see AI transforming healthcare in the future, and more particularly what your personal dream is about how AI can transform. But before I ask you that, could I ask you to share with our audience about the randomized controlled trial that was done with AIMI, which I had never heard about, and then we can transfer into your dreams. But I want to admit that I'm a little scared by what you are about to share. And I'll tell you why in a moment.
Yeah. One of the things I've been watching for, I've been a close observer of all of this since GPT first came out, was I'd say the first few months of GPT were party tricks. You know, look, it can draft an essay and, you know, do it in the form of a character from The Godfather. Well, that's pretty cool. Then it was like, wow, it can pass the medical boards. It can do better than a human on the SATs. That's, you know, pretty cool. But that's still not use in real life situations. And then a few studies from industry where they gave call center operators access to GPT and showed how much more productive they were, and that the end users were very satisfied with it. Okay, that's real world, not healthcare yet. 3 weeks ago, Google came out with a study using essentially a customized tuned AI tool called AIMI. It has all of the world's literature in it, but also it has the results of thousands of doctor-patient digital encounters where patients sent in, I'm having abdominal pain, I have a fever, my arm feels weak, whatever. And they saw what the physician said back, and they saw the conversation back and forth. As you know, these conversations can go on with 5 or 10 back and forths before a recommendation, sometimes a diagnosis and a recommendation, maybe triage is done. What they then did was they took, I think, 20 patient actors and had them pose a whole bunch of real live clinical scenarios. And they didn't know whether they were talking to this AI bot, this AIMI, or they were talking to a real live primary care physician. And it was all digital back and forth with text messaging back and forth. And then they finished it. And then they had the results evaluated by specialists looking at the quality and of the diagnoses and the escalation protocols and the triage. But also these, quote, patients who were asked to judge the empathy and the quality of the communication. And pretty much uniformly, the specialists judged the diagnoses to be more accurate, the ones that were made by the AI, and the patients, quasi-patients, these actor patients, judged the quality of the communication and empathy to be better when it came from the AI than when it came from the primary care docs. So that's pretty breathtaking. Wonderful, again, in a way, if you're saying, what is the system that delivers the best outcomes, the most convenient outcomes at the lowest cost? You'd probably say this is a win. A little scary if you're a primary care doc or an urgent care doc or whatever. I completely get that. But I think we're now beginning to see real life applications of these tools in situations that are completely clinically credible. And they seem to show that these tools are awfully good at what they purport to do.
And I feel so confused about how I feel, because I'm a bubble of excitement and terror at the same time. And I really don't know, if you ask me how I feel, I'm really thrilled. That's really amazing in terms of progress. It's just mind-blowing. And I don't know why, I hate admitting it, but I do feel scared, not for my job, but just for humanity. Like, what does this mean for us in the larger sense as we're going forward? I don't know what to do with that.
No, I think you just have to know that you're not alone. I think that you know, first of all, I think there is a human instinct to root for the humans.
Yeah.
And think that, you know, there's something very special about the stuff inside our skull, and that'll be awfully hard to replicate. And I think we're now being shown that yes, it was hard, but it's not impossible. It's hard to know what to say. It is, I think, in medicine, you know, people talk about how digital has disrupted medicine, and my BS detector goes off. Are you kidding? There are virtually no unemployed doctors. There are virtually no unemployed nurses. There are very few health systems that have gone out of business. If you look at the leading academic, you know, take the U.S. News top 10 health system from 100 years ago, it's probably still the same group today. Take every other industry. My wife works in journalism. Take retail, take travel. There's no other industry that hasn't been turned over. Now, as they've been turned over, there's still people that have jobs. There are fewer of them, but there's still people have jobs. There are new jobs that have emerged. But why is Amazon winning? Because you use it and I use it. It does something really remarkable. Why is Netflix winning? Because it provides, you know, streaming entertainment all the time. So, you know, humans will make a vote. They will vote with their feet, which is better. You know, I needed a travel agent for a trip to Vietnam last month. It's the first time I used a travel agent in years, but it was for something really complex that I couldn't plan myself. Medicine may turn out to be like that. Some of the basic stuff will be done by machines, but there will obviously, you know, the machines are not delivering your baby, doing your surgery, or probably for a while doing a lot of higher end primary and secondary care. But I think that will be a moving target over time as these tools get better.
Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for, again, addressing there is a conflict of emotions, but it is a process. And do you have a personal hope? Because your next generation, also you're a leader in health education and your own family are the next generation. Do you have a personal hope for how you would like to see the changes happen? And do we have any hope in controlling that?
Yeah, I'm really optimistic. I mean, I come into this feeling like our healthcare system is wildly broken. I mean, you have unsatisfied patients, unsatisfied providers, and unsatisfied payers. And so there's a lot of room for improvement. And so, my feeling is there's sort of a short, medium, and long-term set of issues here. I think short-term, you're going to start seeing it rolled out in specific use cases that are just wonderful. I mean, just the digital scribe is like, wow, that's great. It saves me 3 minutes an encounter. That's minutes that I was doing nothing useful. Now, even that though is, you have to be careful. Was there something about you putting pen to paper or fingers to a machine that helped you think through the cases? There might be a little bit lost there, but I think overall it's net good. I think over time, more and more of these tools are going to come out and allow for physicians to have more time and energy and mental space to interact with their patients in a way that's meaningful, to look them in the eye, to allow patients and families to do more things for themselves, to decrease the friction in the system, to make it easier for a patient to figure out who the best doctor to see and get an appointment. I think there's just so much stupid friction in the system. I think that in net, it's going to be good. I think there'll be fewer radiologists in the future, but we'll still need some. I think it will cost some jobs, but I think there'll be plenty of jobs to go around. And I think overall patients will get better, safer, and less expensive care. The long-term part, I have no idea. I mean, it's having seen the AI world 3 years ago versus now, if you say, all right, we're done innovating, then you might say, all right, it'll be a great co-pilot, but only that. But that would be foolish, because probably you connect the dots and say it will continue to get better. Maybe not the same trajectory, because it really was a breakthrough, but on some trajectory. And as it gets better and better, this idea that it's always a co-pilot, I think we've got to be careful whether we're saying that to try to make ourselves feel good, or the tech companies are saying that because when IBM Watson came out and they did some chest thumping about Dr. Watson, they got themselves in hot water very quickly and look foolish. You know, does the tech companies will say, oh, we want to be a co-pilot. We think the doctor has to be in control. What they really believe is that if the tools are better than doctors and cheaper, that they'll take over. And that's what you would say if you were CEO. So there's a tension there. I think it's going to be okay for the short and medium term. And I won't be around for the long term, but I think it's hard for me to project what that's going to look like.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, I think definitely we got to know how the plane works. We got to know how to fly the plane, even if, you know, our co-pilot is the one driving it a lot of the time in the future. And I think it's an interesting future that it holds. And as we wrap up the podcast today, can you share some advice for students and residents who are interested in using AI in practice and or working in the field of AI in healthcare?
Well, dive in. I think it's incredibly exciting. There was a CEO of a company who did something that was a little more draconian than I would do, which is he gave everybody subscriptions to, I think, GPT-4, and then didn't tell people he was going to do this. But a month later, if anybody had not used it, he fired them. Now, I wouldn't do that. But I do think it's absolutely critical, you know, sticking your head in the sand is a bad call here. I think it's critical that everybody learns to use this, learns what its limits are, learns what its advantages are. And we've had a couple of retreats at UCSF in the last week. I held one in my department, and there was another one for the School of Medicine last week on AI. It's a very hot issue. And I was flabbergasted by the number of projects that students and residents and fellows were already doing. So I think for a lot of people of my generation, it's sort of new, maybe I'll try something. But for the younger generation, this is like incredibly exciting, I think. And it's quite natural to them in terms of their ways of interacting with technology. And I think that's the right call. I think putting our head in the sand and saying, you know, we can push this thing away because it's a little scary, that's just the wrong call. I think for individuals, you need to be good at this. And there's some skill involved in learning how to use it effectively. And for organizations, I can't imagine an organization being successful in the future if it's not great at this. So I think we should all be all in.
Got to embrace the new and try to learn and adapt as we are in our healthcare system. Thank you so much for taking the time, Dr. Wachter, and being on the podcast with us today. This was absolutely incredible.
It was a joy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Wachter. I really appreciate all your knowledge, wisdom, and optimism. It means a lot to us. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Leigh Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Leigh Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.